that decision, interesting ourselves to one another. I see the Department for the Olympic Delegation with the young boys in back. Right, I start there from my desk here. Chairperson of the Association of my content advisor here, Dr. Remy. Then my secretary here, Mr. Isaac. And then I'll have members to introduce themselves to you.
Good morning, Chair. I'm from the department. I'm in the bathroom. Morning, everybody. I am Zeta, member of the committee.
Good morning. I'm Jenny Dr. Opus Lazin's member.
Good morning. I'm Kosi Mwala Mwakonya, the diplomacy aid, and the member of the committee from Boas.
One more, my name is Peter Smith.
Good morning, everyone. I'm Ellen Van Enders, and I'm a member of the committee.
Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. My name is Obi Mujumi. Thanks. Member of the committee. Because it's obvious that I was a citizen venture and I'm a member of the committee.
Good morning, goeiemôre. My name is Joanita Terblanche and I am from the Burger Democratic Alliance.
You also introduce
yourself, do you have it back? Good morning, everyone. I'm Shama Nasser. I'm the parliamentary liaison of the Civil Department of Science and Technology.
Good morning, everybody. I'm Charles Conner from the Transport.
Thank you, Chair. Dr. Drafa from the Department of Science and Technology.
Good morning, members. Imran Shah, I'm the DDG responsible for Program 5, Socioeconomic Partnership.
Good morning, honorable members. My name is Bodin, I'm the DDG responsible for International Cooperation.
Good morning, honorable chair and honorable members. I'm Thomas Ostehaider, I'm Deputy Director General for Program 4, Human Capital and Knowledge Systems.
Good morning, Honourable Chair and Honourable Members. I am Nombi Selo Mugwena, DDG Corporate Services.
Good morning, Chair, Honourable Members, and the young boy, I mean, the Department, Deputy Director General for Research, Development and Innovation.
Good morning, Chair and the Members. My name is Libet Mlange, and I'm from the Department of Science and Technology.
Good morning, Chair. Good morning, Honourable Members. I'm Nurun Isola. I'm the Chief of Staff in the Ministry.
Chair and Honourable Members, from the State Department of Science and Technology.
Thanks very much, Chair. Thanks to the honorable members. We're coming here for the second time as a big delegation. This time we felt that the annual performance plan, which is essentially the business plan for this year, was quite important, so we brought all the DDGs
fear that in future will decide on desires of the delegation, especially for the vote and the support. And because we have the opinion that we should be able at the DG level, maybe one of the DGs to do. We have to look at that very carefully in the light of the Minister of Finance has asked all of us to do. Again, we'll be guided by you. So we have really again reminded ourselves of the vision of the work that we do here. Create a prosperous society that provides enjoyment and mutual benefits of science and technology, and we do that by developing, coordinating and managing this enterprise that we're building that will bring about maximum human capital, sustainable economic growth and improved quality of life for all. The five strategic oriented goals for the work that we do, which was submitted in the 5-year strategic plan, so we just want to remind everybody that we would like to develop appropriate science, technology and innovation human capital to meet the needs of society, to enhance South Africa's knowledge generation capacity, to develop the capacity to translate research ideas into innovation within the national system of innovation, to ensure that we have the tools to do the work, world-class science, technology and innovation infrastructure. Also, lastly, to make sure that we recognize that the knowledge enterprise requires strategic international partners and, of course, also to attract others to come and work and do their science and technology activities in South Africa. The policy work is guided by this slide, Chair, which indicates that in 1996 the White Paper proposed the idea of a national system of innovation. In 2002, the National R&D Strategy proposed science and technology missions. And then in 2004, the strategic management model and the role of the DST was defined. And then in 2007, in response to the review of the OECD, we developed this concept of the knowledge-based economy, including identifying additional areas of focus in the terminology of grand challenges. And in the process, we are deepening the implementation of the documents that guide our work. In particular, we do know that the Technology Innovation Agency now is fully operationalized. The Space Agency is also fully operationalized, and the IPR Act is implemented through the setting up of the National Intellectual Property Management Office that we have revealed. So it's a really nice package over time. And our view, showing this slide as well, is that it gives the context of the policy framework that guides our work. But also we are of the opinion that we should spend a bit more time now deepening the implementation and invest less time on yet another policy development process. So as we have said, the idea of a national system of innovation was mooted in the White Paper in 1996, and I think we now know why the importance of the concept of the SI. One, to make sure that we shift from science to innovation. Not shift, but make sure that we focus on science as well as the technological innovation, and also to ensure that science, technology and innovation also deals with the challenges of economic growth, competitiveness and improvement of the quality of life. There was a need for us to have a coordination, leadership, and cooperation within the NSI, something that is still a major problem. We also needed to make sure that the NSI interacts and the components of different activities and entities within the NSI interact in a manner that is going to enhance working together. This is still a challenge, and we continue to look for means and ways of dealing with these two pillars. The National Research and Development Strategy was starting to, again, put meat on what we mean by innovation as articulated in the White Paper. It also asked that we focus our activities even deeper on human capital. Governance coordination, again, is mentioned. And then we proposed a target of 1% of gross expenditure on R&D for the National System of Innovation. We chose some technology missions and science missions. And then the knowledge-based economy, where really we like to see knowledge being the driver of the economic growth in the country. And there are four pillars for this knowledge-based economy. Innovation, which is an activity that we are really trying to drive at the point of time. Education is important. Information infrastructure and then an economic regime and institutional regime that makes sure that all of these four activities work together in harmony to drive the knowledge base. Again, the committee is familiar with the five grand challenges that we have to drive our work over and above the areas that were identified in the end of the year. So this is really just a recap of what we then proposed to cabinet on the external innovation. So again, human capital, knowledge generation, exploitation, infrastructure, global and Africa collaboration is what we set out to achieve in this five-year period. And what I'd like to do in the next couple of slides to share is just to give you a sense of the achievements in some of these areas in the last couple of years so that we can get a sense of what it is we want to focus attention on this year as in the spirit of giving the implementation rather than again policy. We are happy to report that we are seeing an increase in the number of postgraduate students that we support. And you have these slides, not perhaps in the form of bar graphs, but maybe in the form of numbers. All what we have done is to translate those numbers into bar graphs because we thought visually it's easier to see that there is an increase in number of postgraduates that we find. If we look at the researchers that were awarded research grants, predominantly by the NRF, again we see a very, very nice growth from about 2012 to 2,886. If we look at the publications coming out of the NRF, again, there is a growth in the last 3 years. If we now get into the technology side of things, look at the technology support that is provided to small, medium enterprises, mainly through the Technology Station program that is done by the Technology Innovation Agency, and a nice increase. The livelihood job that opportunities that are created, again, we're seeing a nice increase. Just one example of the work that we have been funding over time. Recently, you would know that in our attempt to add value to our fluoride reserves, last year a multi-purpose fluorination pilot plant was established at NECA. And then, of course, we are now in the process of exploring the development of local manufacturing capability of these APIs because they really are fluorine-based compounds through this project. And as you also know that we are adding 20 new research chairs to bring the total to approximately 152. In this activity of the Fluoro Expansion Initiative, we have a couple of benefits. The idea is to increase the beneficiation of the fluoride from about 5% to 5%. In this project of trying to produce API, we hope to create approximately 1,000 direct jobs, 1 billion increase in the value of exports, and then support about 103 students in the process, and then, of course, 103 publications and contract papers and 7 patents have already been produced in the process before initiated. So this, again, is a detail of the project and what it's trying to do. As you know, we want to provide universal access to a number of South Africans. We are expecting that demand for ARV is expected to double. We do know that there is no local production of API that goes into the formulation, and therefore, as a country, we could be vulnerable to the supply disruption price risk, and therefore, we need to start thinking about local production of these, and then Kitapela. To them these are some of the economic benefits. As you can see on the employment side, we hope to create a certain number of jobs, both direct and indirect. We hope it will have a positive impact on GDP. And these are the numbers as well in terms of the impact that it will have on the GDP. Okay, we've achieved all of these things before because, as you can see, in the period from around 1997 up to 2007, perhaps we've had a huge growth in the investment. We were really getting fairly close to 1% of GDP, but the last two surveys are giving signals that seem to suggest both in the nominal rand, in millions, as well as the constant 2005 value for money. We're seeing a slight decline in the amount of money that is expended or used for R&D activities. And this is a worrying sign.
and we will see what the next survey shows us, but we suspect that this trend now is going to continue. So what is it then that, again, we want to do this year then? Again, the objectives of Program 2 are to support ongoing research, development, and demonstration of technological solutions with the intent of promoting commercialization and use thereof, and to provide system-based leadership across the NFI, including regulation compliance functions, and see whether we can optimize commercialization and use of technology. So the work of the Meerkat system is program at this point in time, and we want to continue to make sure that by March 2014 we'll have a couple of Meerkat antennas being on site. We would like to continue supporting, providing technology solutions. By the 31st of March, 15 of these will be solutions that are commercialized or used by the community in the areas of either base science, technology, the energy, or in the background, which is the portfolio that sits within Program 2. They would also be spending a bit more time to try and implement the NPR Act, which was passed and through support of this committee. And one of the things that we needed to do there was to provide some guidelines to the stakeholders to provide some clarity on the optimization and the commercialization of the ideas that are coming from publicly financed institutions. So we will, in fact, not only do this, but we are going to this year going to operationalize the setting up of the National Intellectual Property Management Office as an arm's length regulatory institution working to make sure that the IPR Act is implemented. Program 3's role is to secure South African and foreign funds for both knowledge production, technology transfer, and enhancing innovation, as well as the STI human capital in the rest of the continent, and to increase the number of South African postgraduate students that are participating in international knowledge production in order to transfer an FDI human capital to support the NFR, amongst other things. So even under these difficult times, we still hope this year to leverage approximately 300 million by March in order to support the activities of the partnerships that we have with a number of strategic partners abroad. In the process, we hope to have a total of 845 postgraduate students, that South African students that are participating in these international activities such as SEN, Joint Institute for National Research, and a range of other initiatives that we have within the program. Program 4, the objective is to support and promote research that develops basic sciences, to strategically develop priority science areas in South Africa enjoys a competitive advantage by promoting internationally competitive research and training activities and outputs, and they contribute to the development of representative high-level human capital able to pursue locally relevant and globally competitive research and innovation activities in order to promote public engagement in science, technology, and innovation. So we hope to award 11,208 postgraduate students with bursaries by 2014 March, and then we also hope to increase yet again the number of publications that are coming out of the funding that we provide to the NRI from the research. We'd like to reach out to approximately a million people that are participating in our science awareness and engagement program in partnership with the NRF through the cluster program. We also have made some headway in terms of not only creating awareness on indigenous knowledge systems, but identify three areas where indigenous knowledge could contribute to the challenges that we have in the country. Cosmeceutical area, nutraceuticals and functional food, and we hope to this year generate approximately three indigenous knowledge-based technological innovations and possibly even register patents by the end of March this year. And then Program 5, the penultimate program, their objectives are to identify, grow, and sustain a niche of high potential science and technology innovation capabilities
for sustainable development and for the greening of society and economy, and also to inform and influence how science and technology can be used to transform rural and socio-economic development, can also be used for government planning, and can also be used for service delivery enhancement and the building of sustainable human settlements. And then also to identify, grow, and sustain niche high potential R&D capabilities that can improve the competitiveness of existing and emerging economic sectors and facilitate the development of new targeted industries with growth potential in areas such as aerospace, advanced manufacturing, chemicals, mining, advanced metals, and ICT. So in this area, again, we want to make sure that we have some knowledge and innovation products. And this year, we are modest with two of these, could be either prototypes or patents. In the livelihood area, we hope to create or sustain 400 livelihood opportunities in a range of programs and interventions where we're trying to show the use of science and technology to improve livelihood. We want to continue to increase the number of SMEs that are receiving technology support. Even if you look at the previous graph, it was on 2,000 by last year. So this year we want to increase this even more to 2,300. And in these programs, of course, we also generate a number of masters and PhD students that are coming out of these areas of advanced manufacturing, aerospace, chemicals, mining, and advanced metals. So we hope to support approximately 245 of these students. And then we also want to increase the number of companies that receive the technology assistance package to support and prepare them for getting into the supply chain of state-owned companies. And the program one, their role is to facilitate the development of a competitive, productive, and representative workforce within the department, and to proactively partner with the rest of the department in optimizing performance and improving levels of compliance with relevant policies, frameworks, and legislative requirements. Still a very important function. In fact, this is what the department is all about. We would like to continue our track to reduce the vacancy rate and make sure most of the positions are filled. We are constantly being required by the Auditor General's office and for our own work to have enterprise architecture development that supports the work that we do. So this year we would like to have two of these. I'm told that there are about 14 of these numbers that we have to implement, but this year we would like to implement the document management system in particular and implement this within the department to help IT to have the department in its performance, as well as performance information management system that we are putting in the department in order to help us in making sure that we can provide appropriate documentation for this audit of performance information. So this is the budget in this MDF. So again, we are thankful on the growth that we are seeing into the work that we do, and this is split into the various programs. Again, under these difficult times, you can see that almost all the programs are receiving some modest growth, and we are grateful for this as well. We don't work alone. A lot of work is done in partnership. In fact, the graph before shows that the bulk of money actually gets transferred to the public entities, and I assume that the portfolio committee will be interrogating and engaging with the public entities a lot more. So this is the amount then that we transfer to the various public entities that are under the oversight of our minister. And this just again shows the same thing in practical. Again, this is the manner in which we are structured. We have program one, where we have the COO's office and the EDG Corporate Services Office. And then we have the Self Development Innovation, International Cooperation, Human Capital, and Social Economy. So in conclusion then, Chair, we now, as I've said, know that our work is driven by the policy documents of the department, but it's always informed by the medium-term strategy framework of government. We believe that the performance is satisfactory. We showed some growth in the performance on various indicators.
we acknowledge and appreciate the steady growth in the resources, especially financial resources, but we're of the opinion that more is required. And we're beginning to see the working of the innovation instruments, and we see the rolling out of the Office of Technology Transfer, the operationalization of NIPMO, and they've indicated to us that they are seeing increase in the invention disclosure that are done in the offices of technology transfer. We would like to continue the focus on human capital development, the provision of certain development infrastructure. We have indicated some of the pilot plans that we are putting in place and some of the money that will be used for infrastructure in the facilities in this FTA. We work with our public entities to ensure that they are aligned to implementing the coming priorities, but we're also beginning to develop a robust monitoring and evaluation system. You know that we are rolling out the research information management system, brings the NRS, to collect the data which we can use to monitor, but we are also with the department strengthening the management we have structured. So, Chair, I think this is where I'd like to end on the highlights, and then we'll be happy to pass on the questions to the DG Chief.
Thank you very much, DG, for the presentation. I'll allow the members to interact with you. Honorable members, I see Honorable Smith, Honorable Global Rollins, Honorable Dewey Sotty, Honorable Lion Andrews, Honorable Fachi, in that order.
Thanks, Chair. Thanks, Doc, for your interesting presentation. Three things, I'll go back quickly. On the R&D GERD, the one you said, it's been one since forever, but about 2 or 3 years ago, it was quite clear, I thought, that the Ministry had adopted a 1.5% target, but you're still speaking of 1%. And when I queried this a couple of years back, I was told in a formal reply from your department that in fact it was 1.5%, but we're still speaking about 1% all the time. I just want to get clarity on that. Then, you know, there's a slide that speaks to the four pillars, you know, education, innovation, etc. And we always in this committee have the thing that education is probably the most important platform or plank to this entire exercise working. So as a general question, I'd like to know to what extent your engagement with the two departments of education are yielding positive results in respect of providing the platform for our knowledge economy to grow. To what extent is your engagement changing anything? Then on the specific slide, on slide 19, you're talking about this, the fluorochemical expansion initiative, and again the one after is on the ARVs. To what extent what is the process by which you decide as a department to identify a project of this kind? Is it that the private sector is not doing it? I mean, you could just as well go to a drug company and say, well, why aren't you producing, you know, drugs here or something, or why aren't we doing X? What's the process by which you end up, you know, indicating that these are going to be done? And then once you've got into the process, what happens to it thereafter? You do a kind of commercial, does it become a commercialization partnership project or what? I'm thinking, you're looking at specific targets. Now, one of the targets here was that $300 million for foreign funds for knowledge production. Now, the $300 million, In your budget for the year, 2013 budget, is an amount of $845 million, which is donor funding. So what is the difference between donor funding and the budget and the $300 million here? They seem to me that they should be the same figure, and if I don't understand what the donor funding is. On slide 34, there's a target here of supporting 11,208 persuaded students. Now, if you look at most of these targets, there's a fairly incremental approach to the increase. You know, it goes up 10, 12%, whatever. This one goes up nearly 60%. Goes from what, 7,000 odd to 11,000 odd. 58% increase. How do you intend, is there some massive budget increase to the NRF or what that allows you to have a 60% increase in that target specifically? I'll leave it at that. Thank you.
did not have to take up my work.
Nothing to check. For me, it's a comment and two questions. Let me also join the last honorable member, but thank you very much for a report. That is beginning to ask some of us that are not scientists to really understand step by step, and I personally want to commend you for that. I just want to check the first question, Chair, to you is that in these postgraduate students, PhD, whatever, don't you have a challenge of them being pushed by other countries? I'm raising that because you consistently in your report saying you are increasing human capital to assist the department and the country. That's why I'm that interested in that. The other question is, which is on slide 38 and 37, is that in program 5, the very important bullet for me, the one that talks to inform and influence how science and technology can be used to transform the rural and economic development. You have a program a program that assists ordinary people in those areas to really understand the importance of science and technology in their day-to-day life, or you leave that to entity within the department. The last one, if you say, I just missed that. I don't know. Yes, Mike. You want to facilitate development of a competent and productive and representative workforce within the department. You will pardon me on this. I'm from a sector where health, where we always have some instance training, encouraging ordinary workers. If I can make an example, a general applicant, how the department would always ensure that there are programs to encourage them, either being nurses, radiographers, or whatever. Do we have that in science and technology in the department? I'm raising that because it's quite a subject that was meant to be a I don't want to go into the politics of that, you know. What was then the view of the previous government on science and technology? Now, if you want to develop that, do you have a program that ensures that everybody goes up the ladder? So those are my few questions.
Okay, thank you. May I ask Dr. I don't know, Dr. Phil. Will you please pronounce your surname once and for all so that I can understand and remember how to pronounce?
Thanks, Chair. I actually like Dr. Phil.
That's the easiest way out for me.
Yeah. Juaha.
Juaha. Juaha. I'm writing it in phonetics now. Juaha. Thank you. I stopped following the presentation in front of me because I had the same problem as last week. I worked on the first edition of the presentation, and yet again, the numbers of the slides differ. So it's very difficult. I tried to prepare the day before, and yet again, it was the same problem. So please. Thank you for your presentation. I'm not criticizing the presentation, but the fact that you lose me during the presentation if I work on another document. I have a few questions. I've covered partially by Honourable Smith regarding education. It's my pet subject. You know that science and technology is part of other studies overseas as being part of education. It's all about education when it comes to science and technology. On my slide 4, you refer to the world-class infrastructure. Now, I would like you to embroider on or elaborate on the words world-class and infrastructure. How far are we in reaching this goal of a world-class infrastructure, and what does it entail? And the second bullet is to position South Africa as a strategic international RDI partners and destinations. What are the strategies that the department followed to position itself, and how do we market ourselves internationally, specifically keeping in mind that our education, our basic education, is in trouble. Higher education is also actually in trouble. So we are focusing on this world-class profile, but what about the base? I don't want to focus on too many questions. The one on my slide 11, Honourable Smith focused on education being one of the four pillars. Again, my answer is I'm partly covered. Specifically, go back to basic education. It's so important. Then also on your targets or your performance, on my slide 13, increased research support from 2,422 to, and then it goes up for more or less 400. Is there an objective per year or a target per year? The following slide, you've nearly doubled the publications. How come? What happened to double those or the publication? I would like to know what happened there. And also the slide on slide 15 about the 632 livelihood job opportunities created as opposed to the 396 the previous year. How come? Were these special initiatives or yes, the GetUp Pelop project? I won't ask something about that. And then go to the annual performance plan. I would like to ask a question on, you mentioned the entities and the other agencies and so forth, but I would like to ask you about our contact and our interaction with the Agricultural Research Council, the Medical Research Council, and the World Water Research Commission. We know that, for instance, the Agricultural Research Council is in trouble. And why is are these entities not part of our department? The document refers to the new strategic management model. I'd like to have some more background on that. And is it part of your concern that we should tend to meet with these councils? The other one is on page 8 of the plan. The department has memoranda of agreement with the various departments, trade and energy ministers, all those that are mentioned there. And the document also refers to the joint coordination committees. Would you please give us some more background as to what it entails and how do they function and so forth? Yes, thank you.
Thank you, Chair. Mine is on page 23, slide 14. Yeah, what I'd like to know is the companies that is being assisted in science and technology. How are you identifying these companies? Are they coming forth themselves or are you inviting them? Thank you.
They do not have a hand. I did chair, but I was partially covered by the previous speaker. I also wanted to know how widely is this, basically how widely is it this advertised that people can, do you get approached, or do, how do people apply for the funding? And also, how do you, in relation to another question, how do you gauge the number of discussion documents or documents delivered at seminars and congresses and research papers? How do you engage in that? How do you actually monitor that? Yeah, that's all for the moment. Thank you. Sorry, Chair. I just forgot something. Last week I mentioned two science centres, which one of them was in Northwest. I still would like to know where in Northwest that is situated, because I'd very much like to come visit it and give you the province I have from.
Thank you, Tara. I just want to know on Program 5, how are companies that receive technology assistance packages, how are they identified? And on Program 2, thank you. No, it's only on Program 5 because I went through it without the presentation.
Sure, the GDGs have taken these questions. The first question from Honorable Smith on the clarity on the 5%. I'm sure Mr. Patel will be in a position to explain this. And then on the issues of education and how much the engagement are beginning to provide synergies on work that we do, both that is basic education and higher education. On the higher education, I would ask Dr. Thomas after I, because he's got all the recent engagements that the two ministers have had and the proposals and some gains that we are making with higher education. On the basic education, he may also give a reply on the work that the current minister, when he was the deputy minister, and the deputy minister of basic education have agreed on a set of things that they will do together. And then on the thorough expansion initiative and how these projects are chosen, I will see if I can give the bash, which I will ask Imran as well to come in with what drove us to actually, because it's got two parts. The first part is about the identification of this area as an area where we have natural resources, which blows by, and the constant worry by ourselves and others to say how can we add value, and the fact that we found ourselves in a situation where for some reasons that I don't remember, this unit at Nexa has been doing work in flooring, and therefore it was a combination of all of these comparative advantages that made us to continue to look at how we can maintain the competences in flooring and being able to add value into the floor spot. And then surprise, surprise, we found that the active ingredient in the APIs is a fluorine-based molecule. So, but others, because the question is using this project to answer a higher level question. In some of the cases, we really try and look at the comparative advantage that we have. And secondly, what are the challenges that we have? Could the work that we're doing in science and technology with the comparative advantage help us to solve the problem? And thirdly, will we be able to provide this at a much cheaper and a much more cost-effective way than is currently done by others who are probably not doing it? And then we bring the expertise of the public institutions, but not necessarily them. In certain instances, we identify the need to partner with the private sector in order to take this thing into the commercial phase. And we can give examples of the projects that fall in this category. the area of titanium, maybe Mr. Patel can talk about details of the choice of that work and the fact that we had companies that are interested in this work, and some of the fact that the work that we are doing now is developing technology that had an attraction not only for our local companies but to help them to secure huge contracts in supply chain of big companies in the aerospace industry. And we can give another example of the work that we're doing in biocomposites. So Boneni can give the details on the explanation of the 300 million and the 845 funding.
I can retract that when I see the answer.
Okay, thanks. And then Ms. Dr. Afterhide, 11,000 postgraduate and the 60% increase, I think he has an answer. Now, coming to Honorable Dunja, you have two questions. The poaching of postgraduate by outside countries, Dr. Abdelhadi can answer that. Program France, informal infants rural economic care, do we have programs to assist? So maybe I thought the answer could be answered in two parts. The one part is specific program that we have in order not only to just show how science technology in an awareness program, but through targeted programs that we have in rural areas. And maybe Thomas can talk about SASTA programs that has an outreach in rural areas. It can be answered in two parts. And then I'll ask Nombu Selo to talk about the program that we have within the department. They can share this with Tulane, the COO, things like the women in management, the internship program that we have in order to make sure that we be the next generation within the department. McLaughlin Florence, we apologize for the mix-up of the slide. I'm taking full responsibility for this. When I looked at the presentation after it was sent to you, I thought it wasn't telling a story in a manner that is easy to follow. So I just added one or two slides. And then we turned some of the slides that you have, rather than just a set of numbers, into bundles. So it wasn't a huge change, but I apologize for this. But I thought it would be much, much easier to show the backgrounds, and I apologize. Yeah, we'll try and make sure that we don't do this in the future. The education question will again refer to the colleagues. The world-class infrastructure, and elaborate on this, and the RDI partner. I will also ask Dr. Thomas to talk about this a little bit more. If there's a need to add, I will add about the RDI partner and destination and what strategies. Again, Dr. Boneni of the GDGSR has all the answers for that. Was a question on doubling the publication on slide 24, whether the target is per year or the doubling of the publication, clarity on that. Livelihood, jobs created, Imran can clarify that. I will try and talk about the strategic management model and why we therefore have entities that report directly to this minister and how the others are not. And then the MOAs, Mr. Patel will talk about that, and the joint committees, that's part of the question of the work we do with international people and the use of joint committees, and what I can do about that. And then the choice of companies that are assisted through the TEP and the others, and then Honorable Ted Blanche on the how do we monitor the papers, and then the question on science centers in the Northwest, and then the other one, Oran Bula, is the number of chefs that are funded. Okay, so with your permission, Chair, let me start with the strategic management model, and then I'll ask the DGs to respond as suggested. In 2004, Cabinet approved a model which is now called the strategic management model.
It's divided the research, development, and innovation activities into three parts.
The first part is the part that looks at basic sciences as well as those emerging research areas in South Africa. So in areas such as biotechnology, nanoscience, and other areas, we were asked as a department to focus on those areas. So in other words, to build competencies and capacities in these areas and make sure that the country is ready to utilize these areas for socio-economic development and make sure that the foundations are there for these areas to continue to be useful knowledge generation, maybe partly exploration areas.
And since then, we've spent a lot of time developing our technology program, our nanotechnology program, our geographic advantage areas, the provision of infrastructure, both the physical cyber infrastructure as well as laboratory infrastructure. We continue to make sure we've got the right numbers of students, the right number of researchers. So that's really been the focus of us in this type one. And then type two were areas where the ministries, the various ministries, have to look at using science and technology to address the problems and the mandate of the various ministries. So in other words, in this case, it wasn't so much about developing the disciplines and new knowledge, but it was more about taking the knowledge and apply it to agriculture, for instance, agriculture, in water, medical research. Also, the Department of Health is responsible for the MRC, Water Research Commission for Water, Agriculture will be responsible for ARC, MinTech, and so forth and so forth. So that's how this fit came about. And then the third category is the category where you're using really well-known science and technology solutions to address really services and provide services. The weather service is one example. It's just the modeling and the use of modeling to tell us what the weather will look like tomorrow. So there's no generation of new information. Of course there is, but we are then supposed to work with all of the others in type 2 and type 3, making sure that what we do in type 1 fits into type 2 and into type 3. So that's how this split came about, because of this model. And of course everybody is looking at it at this point in time and say, is it working and it's not working? And we have a range of things where we've started to collect the data in terms of the investment and the performance of the type 2 and type 3 institutions. And I think Mr. Patel has just finished the report, and we'll be happy to make that available to collect. So with your permission, Chair, this group of men and women have got all the answers to the question.
Then, Honourable Chair and members, maybe let me address the question from Honourable Dula relating to the issue of the facilitation of the development of competent and productive workforce. I think the number of initiatives that each has indicated, we do know that we operate in a space where we sometimes recruit people who come from certain fields, the scientists, into bureaucratic environments. So sometimes, you know, there's a lot of mind shifts that we need to do. And so we expose them to a number of training that are particularly public service oriented. So that's one area that we do with Rupalama and other institutions. The second issue relates to young people that we recruit into the department through our internship program, and some of whom we are able to absorb into the department after the completion of the internship program. Actually, tomorrow we have with the group that we recruited for 2012-13. Is actually exiting the program at the end of this month, so tomorrow we have sort of the ceremony that somebody hosts with us then. But as I said, some of them do get absorbed into the department. But also emphasize the fact that we have set ourselves target, for example, for ensuring that our workforce is representative. So we have targets that we set ourselves on disability, which we have exceeded. We have 47% target that we set for women in senior management and position. It's a target that sometimes keeps on moving. For an example, for us to have reached our target in this financial year, we needed to make 10 appointments. But while we're making those appointments, we lose some. So, but I think it's because I think the environment in which we are in is very good that I think it becomes so attractive to other departments. The other thing that also is a reality is that we have a young workforce in the department. 50% of our staff are between the ages of 30 and 39. So therefore, you know, we are trying to ensure that our intervention strategy and career growth opportunities are created to ensure that we are able to retain this young force. I think what DG emphasized is to say how we create a cadre of DSTMVs who would continue, you know, to run the department and ensure that we're not fluid in that area. So really, our intention strategy is actually trying to do that. But as I said, the number of other training opportunities that we've created through the institutions of government and higher education institutions that we're collaborating with, including Stellenbosch and other interests. So really, those are the mechanisms that we're putting in place to ensure that we train and do not lose what we have.
Thanks, sir. I highlighted the seven questions. Let me GERD target, there is only one official cabinet endorsed target, and that's the 1% by 2008, which is passed. So what happened when the minister was appointed, the president requested her at the time, Minister Pando, to establish targets and timelines for a new target, for target. He didn't specify a target. In the discussion, so where the 1.5% comes from, there are two parts, but it's not formally endorsed, etc. I'll come to the second part of it. It was first, because in the 2000, and in the 10-year innovation plan, we talked about what would be an ideal level. And in that instance, we talked about a 1.2% by 2018. So that wasn't a target. It was essentially to say, what would we need as a country to achieve that? So that's where we are. And in the second place, is in the delivery agreement for outcome 4, there was a discussion around 1.5%. But there's no formally endorsed 1.5% position. I think it's been, the numbers have been floating around, but it's not clear. We are still yet to establish a new target to take it to cabinet. Establishing a new target is not an easy process. Firstly, it's based on nothing. You want to set an ambitious target like other countries want to have done, but at the same time, you have to be very realistic. And when we started this work, it was just on the cusp of financial crisis. So we had to, we've been remodeling a number of times to try to get targets. In fact, we've had to create a longer time frame in terms of our most current modeling based on the most recent R&D survey. So this is something that we've been exploring, because when we go to cabinet, which we haven't done because it's been a moving process, either because, like I said, there was a financial crisis, or we got in at the time new information because the most recent R&D surveys were come forth. So we haven't yet gone to cabinet. We have a proposal now, but we want to also test the validity of this in terms of, because when we do issue a target, unlike previously and as highlighted by the Ministerial Review Committee, unlike the 1% target where we set the target and then we just monitor, we want to do things a bit differently now. If we set the target, we want to have in place a very clear strategy where we can even take corrective actions to be able to do this. And it's something outside of our control because half of investment comes from the private sector. So it's a more dynamic process. So officially, there is only one cabinet-endorsed target which has been passed. We need to establish a new target. And that's where we have to, hopefully by the end of this year, some of that debate will come up there. The second issue around, I want to address it in two parts. Firstly, around fluorochemical expansion initiatives, but I think your question was also more broadly, how we select areas. Just specifically on fluorochemicals, the key reason for that is that the major capacity that exists in terms of fluorochemicals currently is in a state-owned state-linked company, which is next. And that is because fluorine is not something that everyone does in a big way. It's highly dangerous, a very reactive substance, you need very specialized equipment, and like the DG said, our fluorochemical expertise came from our nuclear experience in the past. So the reason we got involved in fluorochemicals is because as government, we had a state capacity, largely residing in a state institution. And when we had done technology foresight, et cetera, and we looked at where the world is going to in terms of electronics, et cetera, I mean, every cell phone uses a chemical product that comes from Nexa, as an example. You have to etch your things using xenon fluoride that comes from Nexa. So we supply 50% of the market. The electronics, semi technologies, 50% of the global supply comes from Africa. So this is quite expensive. It changes with market forces. We at one time we were supplying more because I think some other, I think the Canadians couldn't produce it. So we are well respected. We're one of the leading countries in fluorochemicals. And as a government collective, it wasn't DST, it was DST, DTI, Department of Energy, etc. Through what was called the customized sector programs about 10 years ago, identify fluorochemicals as an area that we need to settle and grow and develop. And then on that basis, the DST then looked at its own angle. Now, the storyline, the broader storyline, if you look at that question that you asked, you have to read the storyline from the purpose of Program 5. The purpose of Program 5 is to enhance the growth and development policies of government. And then we're very closely with the sector. So the areas that we choose come, we take the signal from what is coming generally in government, but also looking at what is coming in the system. So each area has very different reasons, and I can go through that. As an example, our titanium We invest in titanium because the science councils have developed very novel technology. So it's government funded things, and we saw a market opportunity for titanium powder, so we would invest in it. And then your commercialization question is that with big projects like this, we developed a kind of a roadmap to be able to take it up. And as we move along the chain of the roadmap, we need to withdraw and get the project number. So titanium is an example. We have between 2.5 and 3 over five phase, which means we still need to involve till about phase 4, which means going for a 500-ton plant. And that costs money, but no private investor is going to take the risk if the new technology is unproven. But if we reach that point, the idea is that private sector will begin, and we are engaging on that bit to say which company, but there is a major company interested, but we are now discussing what do we need to do to get it to be attractive. Like I said, how do we agree what kind of color lipstick we put on this piece in order to get it to be attractive to you? So these are well-established processes. With chlorine, for example, we're sitting with major international firms, Indian firms, Swiss firms, etc., where on particular products, they will take up, and our role then is to produce what we call batch-scale samples. We send them the sample. When they indicate an interest, then obviously you can go with that to a private partner and they can go to bank to save them. So it's quite an elaborate process. So all of our areas, and that's actually our objectives, there's an important word in our strategic objective, is not only to fund these programs, but it's also to identify what we fund. And it's not always the case on strategic advantage. We have to look internationally and say, where are the growth opportunities? A new technology that is becoming world important is what we call additive manufacturing, 3D printing. And we ahead of the pack because we have the capability. And that capability largely resides in the science council. So it doesn't make sense for us not to grow that, but to grow it with the understanding that it needs to be taken up. And so whether it's ICT, each one of them, we go through a long process of foresighting, international reviews in order to decide whether we should be funding that or not. Only when there's market failure, we come in a big way. That goes the same for phases. So that's quite a long process, but we've learned over the last 10 years about how to play a strategic role in this role of trying to stimulate industrial development. The numbers, the livelihood, by the increase from 632, there's a several reasons for that. One is that the footnote that the definition of the indicator based on the smart principles, etc., as we're learning through this process, was modified. Previously, we simply talked about livelihoods created, but we found that that's not a very good indicator because in a particular year, you may create no new job, but you're still funding a set of existing jobs. So that's why we modified the targets to say the number of livelihoods created, sustained or improved, because at that time we couldn't lay claim that we fund a livelihood completely. So if we add additional income, we count it. So there was a counting difference in one respect. And then the second respect is that DSP's primary role is not to create large-scale jobs. And that's not our purpose. So in some way we're keeping it as a target because it's an important national imperative, but our interest is more to come up with a model for enterprise creation that relies on technology. So our interest is more in the demonstration, and through the demonstration, obviously we create jobs, but our real interest is to be able to take that model and convince local economic development partners, etc., to take it up. So it's a slightly different approach. So that's why we have a number, but it's not a number that we just want to continue to increase because we're not in the business of creating jobs per se, but trying to create job potential. The MOAs, we signed these MOAs primarily with the government departments, not with the institutions like agriculture, fisheries and forestry. And these are on an annual basis where we find that we have areas for cooperation. Like biodiversity research, as we highlighted in the last annual year, is something that environmental affairs and ourselves, we would then agree what's the division of responsibility. So over the last 4 or 5 years, we've gotten better at these MOAs, and we believe we have a very good relationship with the cost of government department. Our roles are clear. Where it's not clear, we have a way of discussing it, or getting the DGs to have a discussion, so we don't have that. Rural development, again, we don't have a program for large-scale interventions aimed at just increasing an understanding of the potential.
extent of science and technology amongst rural communities, because we don't have either the budget for that or the capacity. So our work is very focused on projects. Within projects, we then spend a lot of time, for example, looking at science and technology education. For example, we had a water project, and part of the water project is we needed to get people to use water filters more effectively. You can't do that without talking about science and technology. So built into the project, lots of education with communities. We have a big new project looking at tablets in schools. We need to get in the teachers involved or the parents involved. So through these projects, we're able to demonstrate in the project area what's the power. But the SASTA has a mandate for generalized science and technology education. So rural kids take part in national science and so forth. And that's where we do generalized education. And then the final question, there was two. The in-service thing, we have internship programs, but I don't have time to talk about it. But on the program five, we also fund students who then spend time in companies, or spend time, like under the technology sessions program, they spend time in companies. And it's been a very successful program because we lose most of the interns. Even before the internship is up, the companies absorb them and put them up. I think under program two. So we have lots of programs that we really want to get young people into production. And then finally, the tech. How are companies supported? How do we select them? Again, it's based on we have a very well-established strategy. It's called a technology localization strategy. These are not generic companies. It's linked to the large-scale procurement processes of government. So these are where companies like Eskom, Transnet, in the large infrastructure build program, they identify a set of products that they need. And then with the state-owned enterprises under what is called the competitive supplier development program, we then identify sectors that we have to work with, and then we work with industry associations. So a good example is the foundry industry. With our work with Samsung and Eskom, they said they need lots of foundry products. And the foundry products, they want to provide that work to local companies. The local companies were not up to scratch in terms of international production. Either they had very high waste reach or whatever, they were not clean and lean, etc. So through the industry association, we identify the companies, and then what we do is we do a technology benchmarking exercise where we identify what are their gaps. And once the technology benchmarking exercise is done, we then craft what we call a technology assistance program. And then the technology assistance program is provided not as funding to companies, but as services to companies. So we would get CSR, for example, to work with people to look at how to improve their manufacturing processes, or work with the university to reduce the amount of waste, as an example. So it's a very defined process. We have a unit at the CSR called the Technology Localization Implementation Unit, which is staffed by full-time people who then work with companies, with industry associations, et cetera, on a very, very well-defined basis. Unlike a DTI incentive scheme where it's just open up, this is not an open-up scheme. It's linked to a competitive supply development program. So companies come into that, come in because they've been identified as potential suppliers there. There have been very good case studies that have already been publicized where companies have expressed already how this technology assistance package has helped them to improve their productivity or get new orders. It's a very, very
thank you, DG. Chair and honorable members, I'm going to be addressing the question of positioning South Africa as a strategic international DI partner. What we do is simply making sure that we understand what our science system can offer, whether it is in terms of the research infrastructures that we have, or whether it is because of the expertise, or just the nature of where we are as a country. And I'll probably go through elaborate and give some examples. When we engage internationally, we always have committees that are established jointly between the partners. And for them to really know if they can do science with you, they need to have a sense of the kind of science that you do and the capacities that you have. We've got a number of niche areas as a country where the kind of work that you do here, you might not be able to do it elsewhere, or you might not be able to do it
any better than we do it here. We look at, for example, the area of astronomy. We maintain that if you want to do good astronomy, you've got to do it in South Africa or in the Southern Africa, if we also include Namibia. We also know that there is no other country except South Africa that is somehow surrounded by the two oceans, the Atlantic and the Indian, which both present a very interesting laboratory for research into life in the sea. When you want to do Antarctic research, you've got to go to the South Pole, and that means, again, so those are the sort of packaging that when we engage internationally, we say this is the kind of work that you can do. But we also have this case studies of the technologies that we have developed that could, that were not developed elsewhere. For example, when you look at the partnership that we've had in the late 90s, early 2000s, around the government investment in research in deep mining, which involved the CSIR and a number of mining houses. The technologies in deep mining that we developed there were not developed elsewhere. We've got some of the deepest mines in the world. So again, you're able to say if you want to research in this particular area, you're going to have to partner with other institutions to do that. Health research, the various media releases that we have had of late show, for example, that we are leading in the area of research in the space of HIV and AIDS research, the TB, etc. So we've got those institutions that we know they lead not only regional work, but they are leading international research in those areas. So when you have projected that kind of an image of a country, you then find that you are able to have people want to work with you. They actually, as we have seen and heard in the previous presentations, we would not have, for example, been awarded the honors of hosting SKA had it not been for the fact that we have presented a much better alternative. But also that the expertise that we have was just special. So people will therefore want to collaborate with you, not because they feel sorry for you, but because they see that they've got an interest. So you therefore find that South Africa is really regarded as a very special country. Last year, the honorable members were invited when we had a huge international partnership with the European Union when we were looking at the clinical trials research. And again, they have been looking at South Africa as a leader in this work, and even though the program is going to be looking at the rest of the continent, the Caribbean and the Pacific, but they felt that South Africa could actually be the one to take it. So the thing about having a competitive advantage in us wanting to position South Africa as an attractive destination is that you actually don't have it forever. If you blink, you lose it. And we want to continue to sharpen. We want to continue to say, what else can we provide to our partners internationally for them to continue to see us as an attractive destination? This question was also linked to a mention made around issues of education and the fact that we may not be producing the pipeline students to actually help us continue with this going forward. It's a challenge. I think it's really a bigger challenge in South Africa, but when we engage internationally, we realize that the issue of education and specifically getting young people excited about science, it is a global challenge. That is why we have the problem of people in poverty to various parts of the world, and that is why we also poach from the rest of the continent and other places. And for that reason, we are beginning to really look at the concept of the brain saturation as opposed to brain drain. How do you utilize the brain that have left your shores to other places to actually still continue to build on the system? We can learn that a lot from China and India, whose science and technical developments are headed by those who are in the U.S., or who have been in the US and come back. So I think we want also, what we don't want to lose, we say in case we do lose, which is actually always happening, how do we make sure that we don't lose these people forever? They are also going to be, in fact, the same people that if we want to train, we can still say we've got our own in the US and in the UK and in Australia and elsewhere, we can actually send our youngsters to go and be trained. So that's really the concept of our approach to international engagement.
Thank you, Honourable Chair, Honourable Members, and thank you, DG, for delegating so effectively as well. first of all, to start off then with, I'll be focusing on the sort of research, development, human capital development, infrastructure and education issues largely, science outreach to some extent as well. Just first of all on the education questions that both Honourable Smith and Honourable Claude Lawrence asked about. We have in particular with regard to the Department of Higher Education training in the last 6 to 8 months made significant progress in beginning to align our activities in such a way that they don't duplicate or undermine each other, but in fact that we enhance synergies. I'd like to give you some very concrete examples. As you will know, Honourable Members, the Department of Science and Technology has a research infrastructure funding program. Of course, major recipients, not the only ones, but major recipients are the universities. Now, the universities, however, also receive transfers of 2.5 billion rand or so, 25 billion rand or so from the from the higher education department. Approximately, I don't know, 2.5 billion or so is for research purposes. So, so what we needed to make sure is that the investments that we are willing to make in the university sector are synergistic with those that the university sector and the Department of Higher Education makes. Moreover, it made sense to agree a differentiation so that we don't have a situation where, where universities can potentially receive funding for the same type of instrument, not the same instrument, but the same type of instrument from two different government sources. So we have reached agreement, and this has been signed off by the ministers as well, that the universities and the Department of Higher Education Training take responsibility for ensuring that all South African universities have what we call well-found laboratories. So that they all have laboratories capable of training students up to the level of at least masters and PhDs. And there's agreement that the provision of specialized equipment over and above that threshold of a well-found laboratory, that is where our funding programs come into play. So this has relieved us of the burden of funding universities for equipment that's really more routinely used for teaching purposes than it is for research purposes and postgraduate research purposes. So that's one specific example. Another one is that there's been agreement between the departments also at the level of principal, again supported by the minister. All of these things that are reporting have been agreed by the ministers as well. And that is that the Department of Education and Training bursary support programs for postgraduate students, because although we provide the lion's share of postgraduate bursary support, the Department of Education and Training does as well. And there's been agreement that we cannot have as government two different types of bursary programs. We can't have a situation where one department's bursary programs program gets the reputation of being easier or tougher than another government department's bursary program. So again, there's been agreement that the general framework of our bursary program and that of the Department of Education and Training have to be aligned. Another thing that has been agreed also is the Department of Education and Training annually sets aside about 200 million rand for research capacity development initiatives in the universities. And there's been agreement also that that fund must be invested in alignment with our department's research capacity development program as we manage them through the National Research Foundation. We are hoping that the National Research Foundation may eventually become a partner to the Department of Higher Education and Training in investing these funds in this in the university sector, but for the time being, there's been agreement that the frameworks have to be the same. So
So there's been significant significant achievements in harmonizing the way that we fund and clarify our respective responsibilities with regard to research and development support and human capital development responsibilities within the university sector. There's one other project that I'd like to mention because I think it relates to some interest of the Honourable Councillor, and that is we've agreed also to work together on open access publishing platform for South African academic journals that are not captured in international indices. This is a very promising project which ACSAS, in fact, the Academy of Science, will be running for us, but jointly with the Department of Higher Education and Training. And what it'll do is it'll create open access, also using open access technology, so open access to all South African academic publications that might not appear in international indices. This will significantly increase the visibility of South African science and, of course, ease access by researchers, not just abroad, but also locally, to our own research activities. This is another joint project. There were questions also from Honourable Smith about the increase in the number of students. But yes, Honourable Smith, if you look on page 66 of the annual performance plan, you'll see that there's from the current financial year, page 66 of the annual performance plan. Yes. Honourable Smith, there is a table there of the budget for my particular program. And in it, you'll see that there's a 300 million rand jump in the human capital provision from the current year to the next year, which is the one that we're projecting here. And so this is largely accounts for that increase. And you'll see also that in the outer year of this MTF period, there's another significant jump from 1.8 billion to 2.4 billion, 2.3.5 billion. Again, a large proportion of that is in human capital. Treasury has become very receptive to and very responsive to our arguments that we're simply under-investing in postgraduate student training. And they're doing what they can, and you can see by these numbers, Honourable Members, to provide support to the department in this respect. The Honourable Dundua's questions about postgrad poaching, my colleague Boneni has already spoken to that to some extent. If I may just add one or two additional observations. It is completely understandable that one begins to panic at the idea that we're training postgrad students, masters and PhD students, and then there's a real risk that they may leave the country. Now, first of all, there's no evidence that significant numbers are indeed leaving the country and not come back. But leaving that aside, one does, I think, lead on human capital development and especially on the training of the future researcher. One needs to take a longer term view on this. This is not something that's finished when somebody has finished a PhD. To some extent, Honourable Members, it's just starting then, because there is then the so-called period of postdoc research where recent doctoral graduates would go and spend 2 or 3 years immersed in a research laboratory and certainly in developed countries and increasingly also in South Africa, unless researchers have done 2 or 3 years, sometimes even 4 or 5 years stint of postdoctoral training somewhere else in the world, they're not very competitive when it comes to bidding for academic and research work. Certainly in Europe and North America, increasingly in China, Japan, this is the case, and it's starting to become here as well. So this notion of doctoral graduates engaging in postdoctoral research is very important, firstly. And secondly, it is really important that they do it abroad, as much as is reasonably possible, because by doing so, they get exposed to research methodologies, research institutions, research networks, new knowledge sources and research programs that otherwise, in our relatively speaking small system of science, they would not get exposed to. So there's a huge opportunity for us in encouraging South African doctoral graduates within limits, not all of them, but within limits, to spend periods of time abroad learning new techniques, establishing new networks and contacts, and then coming back. The key is, how attractive do we make South Africa for them to come back to? Because there will always be personal ties But we all can imagine that the personal pride alone are not the only thing that determines how you think about your future and where you plan your future. And I think in this respect, the sort of things that we were talking about earlier, and I'll refer to it just now a little bit more in questions, in answers to Honorable Corporal Lawrence's questions about research infrastructure. We are, as a department, I believe, creating a very attractive research environment. Of course, there is a limit to which we can compete with, you know, the leading institutions that whose annual budget just for one institution is 4 or 5 times the department of the budget of our entire system. Clearly, we can't compete at that level. But I do believe that as a department, we're making significant strides in this regard. And indeed, this would be my last comment on this, perhaps then, is to make the point that we have recently been presented with some statistical analysis of South Africa's scientific research output over the last few years, which suggests that South Africa has now reached a steady state with regard to this question of brain circulation that Mboni was talking about. It would appear from tracking the scientific publications of South African researchers locally and abroad, and factoring in the international cooperation, it would seem that we are currently gaining as much intellectual capital as we're losing to other countries. It seems that we're at the level of a steady state in this regard. And that's a sign of a fairly mature science system. So the concern is entirely understandable. We have it as well. But one needs to, I think, take a measured approach to it and a longer-term one as well. On the question of rural development, just a few comments from me quickly. Indeed, the South African Association for Science and Technology Advancement, SASTA, which is a subsection of the National Research Foundation. Honorable members, you'll recall they made a presentation to you not that long ago about their outreach activities, and I understand that they did also speak a little bit about outreach in rural areas. Some colleagues have already spoken about some of the projects that we're involved in, and I'd just like to add a few more comments in this regard. Indeed, for the National Science Week, there is a very strong focus on involving suitable partners from rural environments in popularizing the National Science Week, also in rural settings. I think I may have presented here the statistics of the number of NGO partners in the National Science Week some months ago, including, I think, a breakup of which are urban-based and which are rural-based. But there's a strong rural component to the National Science Week. There are also, of course, various projects in rural areas in Lukisiki-Siki. You know, honorable members, I'm sure, about the one in Tofibaba, and Imran has spoken about that as well. It is one of our flagships of showing the advancement, the impact of science technology in rural settings. In Mafeking, I'm told there are also numerous examples of this kind. And then lastly, the national facilities under the National Research Foundation. They also have a number of outreach activities that are also located in rural areas. I don't know the details because this is all managed at a distance from us. But I did get some information quickly through SMS in this regard. Certainly, through SASTA, we would be able to provide a more comprehensive overview of this. If this is something that you would like to put onto your working agenda, I would be very happy to make sure that SASTA comes and briefs you again. I'd be very interested, too, in that. Honorable Crawford Lawrence, your question about world-class, building world-class infrastructure, and you asked us to qualify that a little. It's, of course, a little difficult to quantify, but I'll qualify it. First of all, your main questions were how do we go about that and how do we know that we're making progress or how do we know whether we're getting there? Well, first of all, it's important to have a plan in this regard and not just make investments in proposals for research infrastructure. You don't have a roadmap. So what we in fact are doing right now is we're developing a research and innovation infrastructure roadmap. This is and the methodology for developing these roadmaps is something that has been developed in some pilot projects in the OECD and in the EU. And we're partnering very closely with the EU on the development of this roadmap. I think I think it's the first research and innovation infrastructure roadmap that's being developed outside of the EU and North America and Canada. So as a developing country, we are, or an emerging economy, we are way ahead of the pack on this. Now, this is both for research and innovation infrastructure, but we're also developing a roadmap for our so-called cyber infrastructure. Because, honorable members, you will know that we've invested heavily in cyber infrastructure, IT infrastructure. We've invested over the last half a decade or so about R1 billion in the Center for High Performance Computing, in the South African National Research Network, and in one or two related other areas. So we're developing a roadmap for the cyber infrastructure as well in order, A, to know how do we maximize the impact and value of this cyber infrastructure, and B, how do we start moving it onto a sustainable basis? Because clearly, we can't just always open up the taps. They need to start understanding how can they develop business models that start increasing sustainability and independence of the cyber infrastructure too. So these are things that are being factored into the development of that roadmap. So A, we're planning our infrastructure carefully. We have also in the department adopted a infrastructure funding framework that classifies research and innovation infrastructure into 5 different categories. And we allocate budgets within those different categories. So looking into what we call high-end facilities, these are things like a fluorochemical expansion plant, for example, the pilot plant there. Specialized facilities, these would be laboratories that are hermetically sealed. So these are specialized facilities that universities can't afford to build on their own, or research councils. We look at research infrastructure, and to each of these categories we allocate budget so that we don't have a problem of having to compare an electron microscope bid by a university against a request to establish a pilot plant for the fluorochemical expansion initiative. These are infrastructure investments that you can't compare with one another. You have to compare them within these categories. So we have developed, I think, a fairly comprehensive approach to planning around research infrastructure investments. How do we know that we're getting there? Well, I think there's evidence in a number of different cases. First of all, the astronomy one is an obvious case. SALT is already a successful international cooperation. It's already recognized as the biggest optical telescope, not just physically, but also in terms of its project, as a project in the Southern Hemisphere. So SALT has put us on the global map with regard to astronomy. Our Karua Ray telescope is already beginning to do that, even though it's a 7 telescope. Meerkat, we know, within 4 or 5 years, it is going to be a leading instrument in the world. The fact that the SKA has come here, Mbonini already referred to it, is a recognition of our engineering, science and engineering capacity with regard to these large-scale research infrastructures. There is another one that I'd like to mention, which is not the responsibility of our department, but it is a world-class infrastructure. And that's the New Orleans research ship. On this, honorable members, we have already begun negotiations, or discussions rather, with our colleagues in the Department of Environment Defense about how best do we pull together their research infrastructure platform, this boat, and our Antarctic and Southern Ocean research activities and programs. So there are, I think, examples of world-class infrastructure in South Africa, definitely. One last one just to mention, we've recently invested, I think, 70 or 80 million rand in a new electron microscope at NMMU. And this is a world-class electron microscope facility in Port Elizabeth. Major investment that we made. To come back to the question of education partnerships, I had given examples earlier on of our partnership with higher education training. You did also ask about basic education, as did Honorable Dr. Lawrence. Very briefly, in 2 weeks' time, the two ministers will be meeting. Minister Hanekom and Deputy Minister Sirti will be meeting. And we will be presenting to them also a number of suggestions with regard to the specific directions in which we would want the cooperation between these two departments to go. There are already a number of cooperation activities, but as within the department we have refined our priorities and needed to reprioritize some of our activities, this may have an impact on some of the cooperation activities that are going on with the Department of Basic Education. Honorable members, you recall 6 or 8 months ago, you asked me to come and speak to you about our human capital development initiatives. The first slide I put up for you was a slide contrasting the financial and institutional capacities
of the Department of Basic Education, the Department of Higher Education and Training, and the Department of Science and Technology. And you were persuaded that there's no way the Department of Science and Technology can change the basic characteristics of our basic education system or of our higher education and training system. That does not mean that we should not have to have productive partnerships, and we do. And around basic education, one of the areas that we particularly want to strengthen in our cooperation with those, with that department and possibly with provincial departments is around the role of science centers as physical extensions of the teaching and learning environments of under-resourced schools who don't have capacity to properly train there and teach mathematics and science. The science centers already, some of the big science centers in Cape Town, Durban, Richards Bay, and Johannesburg already are playing very important roles in partnership with their provincial education departments. This is something that we would like to explore in a more systematic way with the Department of Basic Education, the role of these science centers in basic education. Honorable Klopas, you asked about this increase in the number of publications, and you asked about the number of researchers receiving research grants. Well, you know, what we're trying to do is we're trying to measure the extent to which we support research activities. And what we've got here are two indicators. One is an input indicator, the number of researchers that we support. The other is an output indicator, the number of publications they produce. Now, that one is a very difficult one to measure because in the year in which a researcher receives funding from us, it might be at the earliest 12 months later that they published their first paper. If you assume a normal distribution in the publications, probably the peak of that would be about 3 years down the line from when they received the research grant, but it could have a tail, you know, it could be publishing 5 or 6 years, something that is somehow linked to research grant we gave them in year one. So this measure of publications is a proxy. It's the best proxy we've got at the moment for research output. We also measure, not for the APP, but for our own operational purposes, we also measure the impact of South African science. And here I'm glad to say that the impact of South African science has been improving and increasing in the last 4 to 5 years. It's still not where we would want it to be, but we have greater impact than the size of our science system and of our population would suggest. So in proportion to the size of the population and in proportion to the size of our science system, we have a greater global impact through our research activities. And there are there's scientific evidence in regard to this. The Honourable to Blanche, I think this is perhaps the last thing that I still need to deal with, was the specific questions, two specific questions. How do we measure conference papers and things like that? The Honourable Member may know that it's very difficult to measure those sorts of things. The only thing we can measure with reliance are papers that are published in internationally peer-reviewed journals, either those that are indexed internationally, and there are 25,000 or so international journals that are indexed, and that accounts for 78% of our publications. So we cover most of this there. But then in addition to this, the project I mentioned earlier on, the open access publishing platform, for South African journals that are not in the indices, we will therefore be able to measure all of our outputs that are published locally as well as internationally and in internationally indexed indices. But what we can't do is measure conference proceedings and conference outputs because there's no system that would evaluate them and say this is worth measuring and this is not worth measuring. So we don't measure these things at universities. Specific institutions, maybe they do, but at the level of the system, it's not worth doing that. The last question was on the Northwest Science Centers. I'm told that there are two, both located within Northwest University, one on the Potch campus and the other one at the Mafeking campus. Thank you.
Thanks. Do you want to, on the women in management?
Thanks, Iki. Thanks a lot, Roche. And to add to the program that Tani mentioned earlier on, there's one that is specifically for women in management, which provides some specific coaching, specific mentorship for those who may be in need of that, because it's trying to deal with issues that may be at bat in their further growth and development. both within the organization or outside the organization, hopefully within the public service. So the programs that you put in place and monitor the progress in terms of that. Thank you.
Chair, I think that's where we end the first round and we're ready.
There's quite many rounds, you know, that you can take out your coats. There are many rounds that you still have with you. We'll engage. Yeah, thank you very much for those feedback. I know my members still want to ask further questions. I didn't get also my chance in the first round. I think I will start with the second round. The first thing that I want to observe here, you know, it's good to be patriotic, but it's not good to be patriotic at the disadvantage of the society. You see, when I'm trying to check what Dr. Thomas is saying about our levels of science, because all around there is an outcry about our level of science and mathematics. And indeed, if you read the records which give the analysis from the University of Pretoria from 1985, they seem to suggest that we're not doing very well. The recent index that have been shown where South Africa is in the mathematics and science high school, it's been very pathetic. And so the science cannot spring from nowhere, therefore to spring from the pool that we have created over the years. And so I would like to find out how does he then, how is the compatible with your argument and the published statistics. That's first of all. The second one is about SKA. Well, I can't say because DG knows we work together actually in the mobilization of SKA. Why South Africa has had a very good experience in astronomy since 1820. But amongst other things that made South Africa to win SKA were trainings, which other categories other than that we were very advanced in engineering than Australia. So it's not exactly true, but it is that we have experience, and then we also have some qualities that were taken into consideration. That's why we won the SKA. So I think those things must be put straight. But what I have liked is what I have read recently about the SKA, and which I want you to also clarify me, it is that the revolution of computer is going to be something that has never been experienced. With, I don't know how many people know the size of a quintillion. Quintillion data of processing per second. Quintillion is when you have 10 to the power 18. That's the quantity. So it's a million of a trillion. And so the IBM has partnered with SKA. I want us to understand to produce this biggest computer, which is going to be able to accommodate the revolution of SKA. I just want to get into the detail of that. I'll allow the two members, which I saw the hands of Aurel Smith and Honorable
Lawrence,
Honorable
Dutch. Thanks very much, Chair. Yeah, I think the answers are very comprehensive. I've got a couple of new questions. But first, a follow-up. On the synergy with basic education in particular, I understand the story, of course, the tail can't wag the dog, but I would want to know whether the engagement goes beyond sort of formalistic agreements. Is something concrete? For example, have you as a science department been able to establish minimal basic educational outputs in the sake of, say, science and mathematics, numbers that the system requires, which then could be translated into a basic education target, that sort of thing. Are there pedagogy issues that you guys can put for basic education to help improve output? is there any specific sort of engagement talking to the NDP, which might require a synergistic approach? So I just wondered, how far your engagement goes. I would imagine there's like a scope, but I can imagine also the dog doesn't want to fail to do things. So, how far you go, I don't know. A question to the DG information as well. Last week's meeting did mention this issue of the targets and the issue of the engagement with the AG. I just wonder whether there are any specific examples in this government today which show how the target setting is different to what it was previously, different in the sense of its response to the AG's concerns. I'd just like to see a concrete example of it. Then a question on BRIC. They're members of BRIC. I think there is some high-level engagement in terms of science agreements. I wonder if we could get some indication of how far those have gone and what sort of outputs are expected from it. And then when we were in the EU, the issue of BRIC and versus BRICS was an issue because BRIC was going to be excluded from certain funding, whereas the S part would be included. But I don't know whether that has an impact upon our relationship with BRICS at all. It would be interesting. And then, a couple more actually. This whole issue of research output papers particularly, there is an issue of quantity and quality. Now, if you were talking about peer-reviewed international journals, I don't suppose it's much of an issue. But in respect of the domestic production, which don't go that route, there is an issue here, for example, that certain universities pay researchers to produce papers. And there is a concern that instead of research producing one comprehensive paper, you get five fiddly papers because you get paid for it. Now, UDT doesn't pay researchers for papers. Other universities do. And the specific reason UDT doesn't is because it says it will compromise quality because there's a conflict of interest between researchers doing remuneration and output. So I don't know whether, for example, that's an issue that's common to the tertiary system as a whole, that's problematic, but I would have an issue of quantity versus quality when it comes to the domestic stuff that's not peer review. And then lastly, I wonder if there are any examples. So over the years, when we've spoken with the department in respect of specific projects, these projects are nearly every time we engage, they're at a pilot stage. I just want to know, what has come through the entire stage from 1 to, I think, 5 was mentioned. What has got to 1 stage 5 and is not out there as a commercialized, public, private, whatever entity you like, doing commercial job and is beyond the mentorship, piloting, whatever phase one wants to call it.
Thank you. I would also like to start with the question on education again. Thank you for your explanation about your involvement. But I would like to add to what Honourable Smith said and asked. He specifically mentioned output. But this country, as we focused on world class and everything, but the basis of what's going on in our country regarding education, and it has an effect on science and technology, obviously, is research in education. We refer to the Research Council for Agriculture and for Health, but we don't have an Education Research Council, or does that responsibility lies with the HSRC or certain entities of this department focus in some way? I think it's a huge shortcoming in our country that we don't have that. We do have it in other countries, and it applies to general educational research as well as curriculum development, which is my pet subject because it's an ongoing process. Curriculum development is a science in itself, and we don't accommodate it anywhere. And that is the reason I visited a few schools recently, and the people are up in arms with the current CAP system. We are very proud of a new curriculum again, but it was a trial and error exercise as previous ones, and I'm not trying to accuse the government. We should work together when it comes to education, forget about politics. So let's focus on the main requirement being the basis of everything that happens also in your department, and there is a huge shortcoming, and I plan to focus on this huge shortcoming this year. Just another short question, Mr. Mwenene Muyoke, I'm trying to pronounce it correctly. You used the word people would want to work with us. Now, the Blood Health Project of Britain, did this country approach the department regarding this project? I would like to know, is there any kind of cooperation in this regard? The 1%, only a short question on the 1%, Honourable Smith's question is, how does it compare with other, this target, with other developing countries like South Africa? And then only a final question on the ministerial report review. How are we going to accommodate it? Where do we stand with it? This is a written question in this regard this week, but I would like to know also, how are we positioned to deal with the National Development Plan also? Do we need to reposition ourselves, or are we positioned to deal with that as well? But specifically more about the ministerial report. Thank you.
Hello. Can you close the microphone?
Yes, I'll start.
Two short questions, Jay. On page 9 of the strategic plan for the 2 years, on page 9, there's something that I picked up which was very interesting. One question, do we have private universities and so forth? If you can be answered. I'm quite surprised. But the second one is on the same page, there's a permanent memorandum of agreement with the department. So all those departments are listed there. Now, how do you monitor SDST that what is entailed in those memorandums of agreement is being achieved? Do you do that as the FT, or you do that through your entities? Because it's quite interesting, and one department that one is very much interested in it too, in fact, is transport and housing. With defense, which is my last question, there is a recruitment that is taking place in defense. I would be interested to know if you do link with in that recruitment. They go to schools, they explain to learners what is it that they are doing in the discipline. But what I really want to know is that do you really have a link with them in terms of supporting that recruit as you will be supporting through the Department of Education, through the
knowledge
schools. Those are the only three
questions
from
my side. Actually, that's just a follow-up from one of your questions. I was listening this morning to the talk show when they were interviewing with the Auditor General and the Chair of Scope. Part of what rose there was that the problem, when departments come to present in Parliament, there is no way in which they can produce proof of what they say has happened about their meeting of their targets. There is no proof except here they tell you that we've met this target or not met this target. And that made it very difficult for oversight. That was one of the things that we discussed this morning, which is what Honorable Dujar is talking about, I think.
Thank you, Chair, for the second round of questions. I will not disappoint my colleagues by responding to these. I will do the same and do the best I can to delegate the question. On the your question, Chair, I think we can split then the question into the state of math and science. When I talk about the numbers published and the studies that are done by the HSC in this regard, vis-a-vis, but I think the state of science and math is different from the state of science. That's the distinction we will make in responding. And state of science response could probably be
some of the work that ASAF did and published recently. I don't know, Thomas, if you have the comparison which gives the state of science in general. But of course, I think the link is we should be worried even if we're doing well at the state of science about the pipeline issues, which is, I guess, is at the heart of Chair's question. The recently announced work that we're doing with IBM and partnership, Val, are you familiar with the own project, Astron, NWO in Netherlands, IBM and GA project office? This was in the news recently, but we can really talk about that. Val can talk about that. And again, I'll ask Thomas to talk about this follow-up question. Basic education around the philosophy of the need for a greater scope or explore a greater scope beyond just what we do. Tulani will give examples of the changes in the formulation of targets as a result of the two processes that we've engaged in. One is with the Audit General. The other one is our own processes after that funding by the AG, where we engage in an outside consultant that helped us. Entire department workshops were held around how we formulate them according to the SMART principle. And I think we have two documents here that show how we move from what the AG had raised as a concern before and how these targets are now really SMART. The BRICS and how far we've gone, and maybe Bonini can talk about the outcomes of the last BRICS senior officials meeting and what we have come out and perhaps whether this would affect our relationship with others. I think not, but you can talk about that. And then Thomas knows all the answers to the issue of quality and quantity as far as the research outputs are concerned and how the Department of Education, with the incentive that it has to incentivize, is probably re-looking at that matter, and as well as what are the implications for the papers that are published on other journals that are probably not credited or receive subsidy from the Department of Education. I can give one or two examples, the others we cannot give today. And some of the work that we have been doing that is no longer in the pilot stage. I think I've got four examples here, but we can give that. What we're doing on education at the research level, Thomas maybe can talk about some of the issues and ideas on research chairs, perhaps not the research council, that emerge from the partnership with our colleagues, education, Bonini, the people that want to work with us, issues of global sovereignty. And then maybe Imran can talk about how to compare on the 1% and the others. And then the ministerial review, I can give a short report. We're going through the 39 or 40 recommendations one by one. And the minister has suggested that it may not be possible for us to go through the entire report. It may not be possible for us to take all the recommendations all at once. So what we've done is we've divided the set of recommendations into three sets of recommendations. The ones where we are already doing work on, just to give an example of that category, Thomas has talked about the research infrastructure roadmap that we are conducting. Just identified a human capital development strategy. We are on the verge of finalizing that document. So there are recommendations that are almost telling us things that are already in the pipeline. There are recommendations that are dealing with the governance of the system. As you know, there were perhaps three or four. The one was to form this policy nexus where the departments that are working on education, from basic education or education ourselves, could work together in some kind of a cluster. And then those that are responsible for promoting innovation, ourselves, DTI, EDD, and then the third cluster was social innovation ourselves, social development, rural development, and others. The other one was how do we set up a National Council on Research and Innovation in order to get vertical integration, the link with the private sector. Once we finalize with the minister, we have a proposal on how to act on the recommendation. The other one is the ORIC recommendation. Again, we are working through that recommendation to separate that recommendation into two parts. One that looks at the data collection and how we then do the monitoring and evaluation,
And then the other one, which is about advisory structures within government. And again, we're working on that. We will come with... And then there are other recommendations which need a bit more clarity, so this is a bad category. One of them that I remember was the need to review the mandates of science councils. Now, we need to understand that a bit more before we can act on it, because we think the mandate of the science councils are reasonably clear. And the unfortunate part of that recommendation was then had a part that says then reprioritize the money for science councils into universities. Now, we're a developing country, in my own personal view, to be dangerous to shut down science councils at this point. I don't think the report was saying that, but I'm just saying there are so many interpretations of even that statement that it needs to be understood carefully. The second one that is in this category is that we should have a single funding agency. We don't really know what that means. Does that mean take all the funding for research in government? I sit in a number of government departments. Does that mean create a new NRF? We don't know what that means. So that category will probably require a bit more time before we can go through that. And therefore, as I say, the ones that we are doing, continue the work, ones that are in the category of governance, we're going through them one by one, and at the appropriate time, once the minister has worked out how we're going to take those forward, we'll then probably inform and come and report to the committee. So maybe then if the chair is happy, okay, so that was that. And then the private universities, yes, we have them. South Africa, I think. And then Imran can talk about the monitoring of the MOA and whether we have anything with Department of Defense and whether we work with them on this recruitment trial. So I think, Chair, that would be all. But I would ask my colleague this time to be a bit crisper and briefer, not being detailed perhaps as before, not because we are undermining it, but I think it can be responded to relatively quicker. Okay. We started the program to fund this titanium work, and we're now, I think, in the stage where the project of laser additive manufacturing has been taken up in run by one of the companies in South Africa, the technology that they're using to partner with Airbus. This is a fully commercialized set of work. The second one that I can think of, and Bonelli can give the details, as part of the work that we're doing with our colleagues in Finland, we funded two projects, and this would come as a surprise to a number of honorable members here, where some youngsters from the Cape Flats were asked to develop applications in the ICT arena. The two of these projects. The first one is that in Cape Town, I'm told that on your cell phone, if you want to get a sense of the transport logistics and when the bus and the train and how the intermodal is working, you can get that on the cell phone. This is a commercial product which we are all using. It came from the funding that we had developed under the SAFIPA program with the Finnish government. That's another example. Second one that he told me about is a software for HIV AIDS counseling that is now commercialized both, I'm told, in Finland as well as in the UK. And can keep digging these examples. And I think another one that I can think of is in the biotech area where the original funding from the BRICS program, there are a number of companies that are already in the marketplace and commercial successful ventures from the funding that we receive. So not necessarily funding lately, but I think funding that is coming from earlier initiatives of the department and the partners that we work with. But Tulani, the target?
Thanks, honorable members and chair. On the question relating to what has changed in relation to the targets and the examples, Chair Elizabeth, if you go to page 55, for example, of the new ACP, the annual performance, there is a performance indicator relating to postgraduate students, fellows awarded bursaries and fellowships. how it was structured before, it's really mainly referred to postgraduate students, postgraduate students supported through NRF. What I think we've done now, we've actually been specific that they've been awarded bursary fellowships, because I think it was not clear that the type of funding that was referred to. So that's how it has been improved. But also in certain instances, there was the first approach. There's a second approach that we took. If you go to page, I think, 71, on page 71, these are some of the performance indicators from Program 5, where we've adopted an approach that says, instead of trying to, you know, in a little box to explain everything, then you use the footnotes to try and explain the performance indicator other than just trying to fit it in there, because obviously it's for space purposes. But also I think the footnote approach, you know, was found to be acceptable to the AG and the National Treasurer. So I think those are the two approaches that we've used to try and clean the targets. So it was more also, I think, in the articulation than anything else in the previous one. So really, that's the approach that we're going to be using moving forward. I think, as I said, it is a work in progress. I think come in the next financial year, probably, I think, you know, will improve in the manner in which those targets are dealt with. Because I think they're now more specific and measurable, because I think funding was more broad and specific on the type of funding that you're talking about. Yeah. Oh, yes. Yes, Jim, on the issue, one of the things that we're working with National Treasury is that from time to time when we submit our performance information, obviously we have to provide evidence of that. Now, there's been a debate around the type of evidence that would be admissible for performance reporting. And Treasury, as June last year, promised that they were going to develop standards on the type of evidence that should be admissible. So we are working with them. I think they've taken long in that regard. But currently we do provide from our own sources of information the type of evidence that we have for each of the performance indicator or target that we're reporting on. For an example, I think the issue arose when there are certain targets that are particularly maybe delivered through one of our agencies, in this case the NRF, where, for an example, a list of from the university, you know, if we were saying that we're funding postgraduate students in a particular university, whether the list of names from University X or a consolidated report from the NRF or by the DT is the kind of evidence that we want to provide to demonstrate that. So I think those are the nitty-gritty things that are cleaning up. But in most instances, we do provide that evidence. It's just the type of evidence that they and presentation and the formation package. That's the standard that I think the National Treasury is still trying to ensure that it develops a common standard.
Exactly what they said today between the Auditor General, he said that they have produced a performance dictionary. In this performance dictionary, they have looked into all the guiding documents such as MDF, or such as the Constitution, such as what do you call it, PFMA and FMA and MFMA and so forth. So they said they have combined all those, and even consequences are there for your accounting officers to know that if that has not been done, this is a consequence. So they said this is the performance dictionary which they produced, so it's there.
But in all our cases, we do support provide evidence for our performance.
On that last point, just to add on, because Lani didn't mention it, departments are also required to put on their websites an indication of how you collect the data, so that will be available to the public and members to then dig into it, because it's very complex, you know, how do you count something is all then, we required to define it very explicitly in the data and the evidence and who checks the evidence and the quality, etc. So it's an evolving process. Just a couple of comments on my side. How do we compare with other countries on GERD? I was trying to find the numbers, but in general, I know that we have a briefing plan to the portfolio committee around the R&D survey and a whole lot of things, and we'll give much better data. But in general, developed countries are between 2.5% and 3%. Yeah? And we know we're near that.
the African continent in general, I think it's sitting about 0.4%, so we're higher than that. But our peers recently, we're talking about the BRIC countries, have significantly overtaken us in recent times. But they're not sitting at like 2%, they're sitting at 1.1%, etc. But the difference is their 1.1% is orders of magnitude greater than our 1%. So, yeah. I think with Latin America, it's about 0.8%. So we can provide these kinds of statistics in detail, and they do get we do have some of these numbers in the R&D survey report. But I think when we do come back with those things, then we can give people a better sense by continent, etc. And the information is also for different periods because we use that for the information. The DG answered the question about an example of something that has gone to full stage. There's many other examples, and I think we've identified it as this is one of the things we're going to have to do is document. Try to get a sense of different initiatives and how they are now that we've developed experiences. So hopefully that's part of what we are currently doing. We are looking at where we are and comparing ourselves to other examples. The MOUs, some sports in humans, because these are internal MOAs between that the DG is signed. My program has a certain difference at chief director level, at director level, who are responsible for different MOAs. They're based on their portfolios of work. So people are very intimately involved in all the details of these MOAs, and we monitor them almost weekly, monthly, because we all constantly on the phone with people. So it's not an issue, because we sit down and we agree what we jointly do. The agreements are at different stages. So in terms of transport and human settlement, transport is not one of our stronger MOAs at the moment. It's not one of our stronger partners. Human settlement was not. That has recently changed. We now even have a case where we've identified joint projects, for example, around the review of the green paper on housing and some of our work, etc. So it's evolving also. Sometimes depends on personality. So there's a lot of human factors in management, but it's defense, we don't do much on our angle with defense is mainly on the technology side. So we work very closely with defense when it comes to aerospace, because aerospace and defense, you know, there's interchangeable technologies like unmanned aerial vehicles, etc. But on recruits, we don't provide any necessary support. It's not an area that's come up. So we work with them on issues around ICT, security assets for ICT work, or we work with them with our aerospace advanced protection.
Thank you. Thank you so much. I'm going to also clarify, just clarify the two programs that the DG has selected on that have moved from the work that we supported that are now making an impact in society. There's two projects. One is what we call the Reconstruct Living Lab, which is here in Athlone. We have borrowed this concept of Living Lab from the EU, where they look at how technology can actually contribute to the development communities. And we funded these youngsters from the CAVE Lab who were looking at developing mobile technologies that would assist in the counseling of depressed people, whether they are people who have been abusing substance or addicts, etc. Now, they developed a product that, as DG has indicated, is now being utilized not only in South Africa, but in a number of countries. They have opened up offices. They've got a part of offices in Joburg and in the Eastern Cape in Port Elizabeth. But what is important is that since we funded them, they now are self-sustained. They don't get any money from us anymore. They sell their products and they are able to pay for their own occupancy, etc. But most importantly is that they have now directly employed close to 50 people. And the people that have been employed is not your graduates or people of glorious past. But they have, because they call themselves the Reconstruct Living Lab, they identify these people who were former drug addicts and who, even if there were billions of jobs around, nobody would employ. So they are bringing them, which means they are contributing really to the
potential challenges that we have. So that is really the one project. The second one, people are familiar, of course, with the Yummy Shuttle at UCT, the MyCity initiative here, and also the Golden Arrow bus services. There's something called Wellington Transport, which is used in terms of when you know when your bus is coming, etc. That is also the system that was developed also with our investment from the partnership with the government of England. The youngsters who were graduates from the city were developing the same day, apply for funding from myself. In terms of the BRICS, EU, and the science and technology programs within BRICS, immediately after our joining the BRICS, there was an establishment of the senior officials meeting, which is a meeting where the senior officials of both members need to decide how they're going to cooperate. So the first one was held, I think it was in China, and then the second one we hosted in South Africa last year in November. We have identified various areas on the basis of each country's strength, where a country will lead a specific area. For example, we have ourselves leading cooperation in astronomy, and we've got Brazil leading in the area of, for example, bioeconomy. And we want to move there to see, for example, how can we, through this partnership, help implement some of the grand challenges that we have identified. So it's, the science and technology program is still very new, but at least now we are in the process of working out the memorandum of agreement between the parties, which will have the implementation. But most importantly is that later in this year, we are going to host the first BRICS Science and Technology Ministerial meeting. That's going to be in October. So the those programs are really going to be going on. How that impact, you know, when we look at the decision by the EU, not, for example, to support the financially the participation by other, by the BRIC member into their science and technology program. It's really a matter of how one negotiates your way into this partnership. We have, for a long time, been discussing the EU. For example, they have the under the Africa EU partnership. It is clear that the science and technology chapter, which is called the AID partnership, will never be successfully implemented unless South Africa is there and is leading. And our continued partnership and getting support from the EU becomes one of those facilitators of the implementation of the Africa EU Partnership 8, which is Science, Technology, Space, and ICT. So that is why we continue to benefit from various new programs. But the other thing, of course, is we have also learned that if you want to continue to partner long-term, you need to know the cycles of planning and further terms of policies and strategies. And we are very familiar with the EU's cycle. So we decide to get involved when they are still making inputs into what their policies are going to look like from, for example, 2014 to 2020. We want to hardwire our partnership into those policy documents so that when you come in later, you know we are already inside. So that's what we have done with the EU. It doesn't create any strain between us and other BRIC members. Lastly, the point on the Bloodhound project. We have not been approached. One of the things about, for example, our partnership in the UK is that it's very good at institution-to-institution and scientist level, but we don't really have a government-to-government framework. The UK has just appointed two scientific officers. One is based in Cape Town, the other one is based in Victoria. And we have been planning to have meetings which we haven't had yet. And the
planned meetings are really to discuss how do we then have government programs that we can begin to implement together. Thanks.
Thank you, honourable members, for the second round of questions. In fact, the DG was not very effective this time because he already preempted many of the answers. So I will try and add a little bit of value to what he's already responded. Briefly on the education question, the question around the contrast between the level of science and mathematics at schools and our status as a science system. The DG made the point already that there are two systems here. One is the school system, the other one is the science system. Of course, there's a link between them, but it's a link that exists over time as well. And I guess the easiest way to understand, or the way that I understand the dilemma that the Chair put on the table, is that at the moment, whatever weaknesses there might be in the schooling system, at a statistical, at a system level, there is still enough good matriculants coming through to populate the university system, and there are still enough good graduates coming through to provide us with good researchers and postgraduate students. There is no evidence that that this system is in crisis from that point of view. As I said earlier on, the indications are that, well, first of all, you've seen yourself, and I'm sure the NRF will present you this information as well. The volume of recent output has increased, and this is probably quite strongly linked to the incentives that the Department of Higher Education and Training has put in place, which some universities deal with differently from other universities, but none of the universities have said there should be no incentives. Secondly, there is really good evidence from psychometric analysis that the quality of South African research has not dropped, despite the concerns expressed by some in the university system that the focus on quantity has undermined the focus on quality. At this point, there is no evidence in this regard, particularly with regard to South African research that is published in journals that are indexed internationally. Now, many South African journals are also indexed internationally. So what, however, is it has also come clear from a study that was done for us is that the impact of publications by South African researchers which have no international partnerships, that has declined. In other words, the impact of South African research that is internationally networked, where, in other words, where there are South African authors and international authors, where this is published, the impact of that research globally has improved. The impact of publications by only South African researchers has not. So this is what the evidence suggests to us. And this is factoring in all kinds of things that might make it skewed or so on. So there is evidence that the quality of South African research has improved at least insofar as the impact measure, because impact, of course, is only a proxy for quality. How do you measure quality? So we measure it within the statistics of science, we measure it through the impact. There are specific indicators to which we measure impact. Citations and so on, those sorts of things, exactly, honourable member. So at this point, this is my personal view. Of course, I am concerned about the long-term sustainability of our science centre, because our ambitions, and we have to, grow our science system. And we can only do that on the back of more young people becoming involved in science and having the appropriate expertise and skill set and knowledge to become involved in it. So, yes, certainly. For me personally, I am concerned about the long-term sustainability of our science system in terms of what is happening in science and mathematics at university, at school level. I am not, however, a specialist with regard to science and mathematics teaching and learning at schools level, so I would not want to make a comment in this regard. It is true that, and I need to stress the point, there are in fact, and Honourable Crawford Lawless, I'm sure you will be aware of this too, there are in fact many researchers, education researchers in South Africa. Most universities have got education policy or curricular studies, researchers and research programs, and training programs as well. There is also the Council for Higher Education. There is, of course, HEFA, which also does some research on education matters. So I think there is a rich education program in South Africa as a whole, including within the HSRC. I don't know the details of what their work has been recently. Imran might be better placed to comment on that, but I don't know the details of what they've been doing at the moment. So I think there's a fairly comprehensive understanding of what's happening in the schools beyond the, you know, the newspaper headlines about international comparative analyses. And I think there's also evidence that both the Department of Higher Education and Training, and particularly the Department of Basic Education, is utilizing that knowledge and research skills based in South Africa to inform their policies. And many of our pilot projects, the Tofimbala, for example, are pilot projects which we're engaged in partnership with these respective departments in order to demonstrate the value of science and technology in addressing some of the challenges in the Department of Basic Education. So I know that nobody would think this is a trivial problem, but equally I also don't think that anybody is approaching it with trivial solutions. So I'm afraid from my own personal perspective, this is the best answer I can give on. The specific question you've asked, Honourable Smith, is about the improving the DB, the synergies with the DBE. You know, it's my job as a departmental official to make sure that the joint initiatives we engage in with the Department of Basic Education address the mandate of this department. We want to try, of course, and address the mandate of government as a whole, but it has to be done through the mandate of this department. And so one of the clear lines of distinction between the Department of Education and the Department of Science and Technology is that we have no mandate for dealing with issues of pedagogics. This is, of course, we support research in pedagogics, but as a department, we have no mandate for dealing with pedagogics. And it would be inappropriate, in my view, of us to develop some kind of initiative beyond the notion of sort of pilot projects, where we are looking at how can science and technology improve the pedagogic of learning and teaching. That's a different issue. But developing, you know, positions or policies around pedagogic issues in the education sphere, I don't think is appropriate. It's not a mandate of our department. So we do joint work with the department, but on specific initiatives that are of mutual value and reinforce the mandates of both departments. And there are enough opportunities in this regard. And if you wanted to, certainly we would be happy to come back, Honourable Chair and members, to present you with some more details. I mean, if you, for example, wanted to have a joint meeting with your colleagues in the education committees and explore, you know, what is going on jointly, we would be able to present you, I think, with an interesting presentation that would enrich your understanding of how we're managing this interface at the interdepartmental level. I think the only outstanding thing is the question just on the private universities. On this one, the DG did delegate effectively. He just said yes. I think Honourable Dunjoy, this was, I think, your question. There are many private universities. Most of them, however, are very single-focused. They might have a program in Master of Business Administration. Most of them have MBA programs, and that's what they're in the country for. They just run an MBA program. There's one in particular which has a much more comprehensive program, university program, that's Monash University, which is based in near Johannesburg. And that has a comprehensive set of programs. I think that's 3 or 4 different faculties, and with a wide scope. Most of the other private universities are single focus. It's important to mention, though, that in order to operate legally, they are all accredited by the Higher Education Quality Committee, and their programs are all structured within the National Qualifications Framework. So this is a well-regulated environment, to the best of my knowledge, not being official from that department. Thank you.
Thanks, Chair. You inquired, Chair, about the DOME project specifically, which is a four-year partnership between the SKA, Reggie Astrum, and the IBM. I think you provided a useful starting point trying to explain what a quintillion bytes is. Just to give you a sense, the SKA will be producing 2 exabytes of data a day, and 1 exabyte is 1 quintillion, which is 10 to the 18 bytes. You've got 2 times 10 to the 18 bytes. And to give you a sense, to give you a sense of what that means is that if you take current internet traffic in the world, the SKA will be producing 10 times the current volume of internet traffic in the world. So you're dealing with extremely large volumes of data. So you can understand, Chair, and appreciate the fact that if you want to make sense of this volume of data, you have to process large volumes of data at extreme rates. And so, in terms of the rate, the faster computer, what is called 2.5 petaflops, that's producing 10 to the 12 operations per second. So you can understand the volume of data and number of operations, the faster computer, what it can do. And so if you want to use a computer that can make sense of the data, you need a computer that's 100 million times faster than the fastest computer that currently exists. You're dealing with large volumes of data and you need extremely fast processing capacity. So what the initiative is trying to do is trying to produce this platform, which will do software analysis, but also do what is called machine learning. So you're building in artificial intelligence where you're training the computer itself to learn on its own how to analyze the data. So you're bringing in this component of what you call machine learning, which is artificial intelligence. So the biggest aspect of this is teaching the computer to teach itself. Okay. And what we're hoping is that we begin to make much better sense of the data at a much quicker time, kind of almost real time. And so what IBM is bringing is obviously the computing capacity. What Astron is doing, you can appreciate that as you develop the software, you want to make sure that the astronomers make sense of the data. So Astron is a radio astronomy institute based in the Netherlands, and so they bring the astronomy expertise into this, and obviously the SKA is coming with the infrastructure and that will talk to this. So it's a four-year partnership project that we're looking at this problem. Thanks.
Thank you very much.
So you're
going to see what the SKA is bringing. You know, if you could imagine that in all these millions of galaxies, if it has to handle them, it has really to have the power which has never been seen before. And so those are times of imagination that I like when I think about SKA and radio astronomy. Right. I think let me come to the conclusion. Oh, just before, let me just clarify the analysis that came from the Department of Engineering Systems, Engineering Management Systems at the University of Pretoria, was showing a trend from 1985 to 2005 that mathematics and science in South Africa only grew at high school level, and said it grew from 15% only to 16%. And they were saying that actually out of that 1%, 61% actually came from white students, means Model C schools. So it was a pathetic record. And 2 weeks ago, there was another record which showed that out of 144 countries, we were rated number 139, maybe you heard about that record. So these are statistics that I'm studying, because you see, 1985 is a long time, and it's changing, then it means it's deteriorating, because if by 2 weeks ago, you are still, in fact, you are regressing to 144, then it means that the switching is not right. So that's the reason that I was talking about that. So it's better that we don't comfort ourselves. We try to pull up our socks because the situation is not getting better. That was my meaning. Okay, but otherwise, thank you very much for the presentation. I think we've learned a lot. We've learned about the quintillion now. There are so many things that we know. When we arrive out of here, we talk quintillion.
Oh, now,
we just want to check here, with this, something that has been introduced here, the airport, can you give us quickly about the airport, because we hear it looks like there is a shortlist that has been introduced. Can you brief us quickly so that we can put ourselves? Because I did, many things, somebody told me that you were looking for, I think, one candidate or something like that, but I see it's a whole board that the office has come to.
No, you'd recall that the TIA board was appointed in 2010. So in 2009, now the term of the board has come to an end. It's come to an end actually at the end of April, which is and therefore we started the process of reconstituting the board by following processes as stated in the legislation last year. So now it has reached the stage where it must be called that. By Parliament, and therefore, and then before the minister finalized that amendment report. So we are hoping that the portfolio committee will then go through the names that the panelists that by the minister on short is compiled and submitted to the minister so that he could submit to Parliament. So this is where we are. So we're hoping that before the Easter break, that the committee might consider the shortlist so that it enables us sufficient time to submit to Cabinet in April.
Thanks. What happened to the legislation to incorporate AIFA into HRC? Because I thought you had also said it was going to come around March also.
Yes, the Cabinet approved the legislation last meeting. So actually they are process of introducing it is underway. So I think in the next 2 or so weeks they should be introduced into Parliament.
A little bit busy. Okay. Thank you very much. We just wanted a clarification because there is something that has been introduced here to the speaker for the shortlist already. Which means that we need to start attending to it at committee level. But otherwise, thank you very much for the presentation. When is your next presentation? Now, until the budget vote, so you won't come back.
Just become the board call.
Okay, all right. Well, thank you very much. The session is adjourned. Thanks.